This is a podcast by The Straits Times.
Hi, you're listening to Green Pulse, and I'm David Fogarty, your co-host for this channel with No More Gauche. Now, depending on who you speak to, carbon credits hold great promise as a tool to achieve deep cuts in carbon emissions to fight climate change. Or they are a scam that fails to deliver what they promise. A major problem around the carbon credit market is trust and transparency. Do carbon credit projects achieve what they pledge? How can we be sure? And will local communities benefit? Ultimately, carbon credits should be treated like any other financial asset. They should be held up to scrutiny. And that means they should be rated for their quality and integrity, just like bonds. And increasingly, that is exactly what is happening. Several companies now offer rating services for carbon credits to help buyers make better choices and meet due diligence requirements. But will this be enough to answer the critics' concerns about the carbon market? To learn more about this, we speak to Mr. Duncan van Bergen, co-founder of Calix Global, a carbon credit ratings company based in Singapore. Welcome to the show, Duncan.
Hi, David. It's great to be on the show. You've had some amazing guests, and I'm feeling very honored to be here.
Great. Well, you're another amazing guest. Thanks very much for coming. Now, let's get started. Carbon credits have been in the news a lot recently, and not always for the right reasons. Can you explain some of the main concerns?
Yeah, so the press and also some NGOs and other institutions have touched on the topic of quality of carbon credits a lot, especially 2022, 2023. There was a lot of news on this topic. Although, to be fair, the areas of concern haven't always been the same. Sometimes the concern has been around over-crediting. Yeah? Are these projects issuing too many carbon credits for the amount of reduction or removal in CO2 that they're actually doing? Sometimes the criticism was around, are there effective safeguards in place to make sure that these projects don't have any nefarious impact on the communities where they work or the natural environment around them? And some other times it was around additionality, which is really core to carbon crediting, which is, would this removal or reduction activity have happened anyway, even if we hadn't financed it through carbon credits? So those are some of the different critiques. And for people like myself and my co-founder and a lot of the people in Calix Global who've been around in this market for a long time, some of these criticisms weren't a surprise. And that's, I guess, why ratings agencies like Calix Global were created. We see the need for providing an additional layer of scrutiny to the market and to help buyers who want to make sure they buy credits that are real, that have the real impact that they claim to have, that they can buy those and that we provide them the information for that. Now, the flip side of all that attention, it's actually quite exciting. It has led to an acceleration of a movement of improvement. Yeah, people from the standards that certify these credits to the whole ecosystem have been much more acutely aware of quality and integrity. And so the pace of change has picked up. The last thing I'll say is, and it's kind of weird to tell this to a journalist, but bad news sells best. And so, yes, there's been a lot of reporting on the areas that have been problematic, perhaps too little on those areas that work really well. And there's some amazing projects out there who do well, both in terms of really fulfilling the claim of standing for 1 ton of CO2 reduction or removal, as well as in terms of their impact on communities. So let's not lose that perspective either.
Great. And as you mentioned, you know, there has been quite a lot of negative press around the market. And this has really taken a toll on the voluntary carbon credit market over the past 2 years, which seems to have largely sort of stopped growing. And the element of trust seems to have taken a bit of a beating, if that's right.
Yeah, I think you're right. Look, there was a tiny bit of growth last year, but definitely not what we'd seen in the 2019-2021 period. And I'd say two factors were at the root of that. One is macro, just the economy, interest rates, companies perhaps scaling back a little bit on their spend on climate action, but also definitely trust. Yeah, trust has suffered. There was a bit of a trust deficit in this market, and that has led to some companies becoming afraid to make commitments to buy carbon credits, afraid to then be associated with carbon credits that are then revealed to not be what they claim they are and suffer the negative consequences of that from a reputational perspective. Therefore, the job of all players in this ecosystem is to do what it takes to restore trust. And that is happening. We're seeing the standards, yeah, bodies like Vera and Gold Standard and others tightening the requirements of some of the methodologies that are used to create carbon credits. We're seeing new players in the ecosystem like ratings agencies. There's also industry initiatives like the Integrity Council for the Voluntary Carbon Market and a few others. This space is rife with acronyms. There's the ICVCM, the VCMI, the SBTI. There's just so many, but all of them trying to put together a coherent framework for increasing integrity in this market. And as a result, whilst I wouldn't say that, hey, the heady days of growth are here, I am seeing more positivity. I'm seeing, if you look at the first quarter, retirements are up by something about more than 14%. And so it suggests that maybe there is an era of green shoots coming. It's early days, but let's see. And I'll repeat again, there are good carbon credits out there. And so if buyers are willing to do the homework, get the right information to help them make the right decisions, I think there is good action to be taken.
Yeah, so that's a nice segue into my next question. And that is, what does a high quality, high integrity carbon credit look like?
Well, let's go down to the basics. First and foremost, high quality means that you, the buyer of the credit, can trust that the claim made by the credit is real. Now, whether that's a claim, the core carbon claim, you could call it, a carbon credit is supposed to stand for one metric ton of reduced, removed, or avoided emissions. And then on top of that, many carbon credits also make claims around making a contribution to sustainability, often measured by contributions to one or more of the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. So those claims also need to be real, substantiated by real evidence. And finally, I'd say the third dimension is in terms of no negative consequences, the do no harm principle. People want to be sure that the project that creates these credits doesn't actually have any negative impacts on the communities around them or on the natural environment around them. So those are really the three. But at the core, you need to be able to trust that the claim made by a credit is real.
Now, you've co-founded Calix Global, which rates carbon credits by closely vetting the projects that remove carbon dioxide or avoid it from being emitted, as you've already explained. So tell us why you helped set up Calix Global and how do you actually go about rating these different types of projects out there? And of course, there are quite a number of different project types these days. It's not all just about forests.
David, this is a dangerous one. Now I'm going to start nerding out on exactly all the frameworks we use to do the ratings. You'll have to say, stop, this is enough. But yeah, so we assess three different aspects around carbon credit quality. First is greenhouse gas integrity. Yeah, that really tries to answer the question, is a ton a ton? Does this credit really stand for a ton of reductions or removals? Second aspect, SDG impact. Is there substance behind claims that the project has a positive impact on one, two, or more of the United Nations SDGs? And the final aspect that we started assessing, and we added this at the end of 2023, we're starting to assess safeguards against environmental and social risk, as I alluded to earlier. And we've developed some fairly elaborate rating systems around each of these three areas that we think complement each other. Above all that, we've also set in place a governance process. Yeah, we have three independent oversight panels staffed by really leading experts, people who've been active in this field for one, two, and in some cases, 3 decades or more, to provide oversight on the way in which Calix Global does these ratings, the frameworks we have developed, the frameworks we use to do those ratings. But just to dive one level deeper, when you look at greenhouse gas integrity, so the is a ton question, we have analysis frameworks that guide our ratings that are unique to every project type that we rate. And we today cover 20 project types, some of them nature-based, some of them technology-based. And they ladder up in a way into one overarching framework, one umbrella framework that makes sure that the ratings we issue are comparable so that a B rating on a landfill gas methane capture project means the same as a B rating on a reforestation project, for example. And similarly, for SDG impact, we have a rigorous framework that looks at, is there evidence pointing to real impact, or is it just activity that's happening that is contributing to, say, SDG 4, quality education, or SDG 5, gender equality? Is there just evidence of an activity taking place, or can you actually measure outcomes from that activity? Quite different. And also, what's the quality of that evidence? Is it just a story like, hey, we built a certain number of toilets in the communities. Great. That's a nice story of an activity taking place, as opposed to here's a data series over a number of years of how waterborne disease has decreased in the community. So those that type of differences we look at. But yeah, that's the job of a ratings agency to have really rigorous frameworks at quite a level of detail, with clarity around what type of evidence counts towards ratings and how to assess that evidence. And that's what the people at Caylus Global are doing day in, day out.
Great. Now, you rate projects from the highest grade, which I think is A+, all the way down to E. And so what percentage of carbon credits are on the highest grade, and how many sort of more towards E? From what I've seen from your ratings, there aren't too many at the highest grade, and there seems to be quite a lot in the middle and also quite a lot towards the lower end of the spectrum. So tell us a bit more about that and why there's not so many at the very highest sort of rating.
So you're right, David. And by the way, anybody can go to our website and the resources section, they can see that distribution live every day as it changes. But you're right, at the highest A+ rating, it's about 5% of the projects we've rated are there. And if you went down to include A and then the B-rated projects, you probably get closer to 20%. And that's a reflection of the state of the market. Yeah, some projects have issues with additionality, as is the case for some of the large grid-connected renewable energy projects. Why additionality, just to call a spade? A lot of these projects would have existed with or without carbon finance. And we find in some cases that these projects existed well before they actually applied for carbon credits issuance, which kind of goes totally counter to the logic of additionality. In some cases, it's problems of overcrediting or permanence, and some of the forest conservation projects suffer from that. The Red Plus, not all, but some of them have problems with that, in the sense that the amount of credits being issued is out of sync with the amount of saved emissions or reduced emissions compared to a conservative and credible baseline scenario, and so forth. So the problems are differing across different project types. Why are we here? A lot of that is perhaps a legacy from what people are starting to call carbon markets 1.0. Yeah, the early methodologies perhaps had latitude that people took advantage of to issue more credits. And that was also based on the economic incentive. Carbon prices used to be very low, and so people perhaps did what it took to be able to get some of these projects off the ground. I think we're in a different era now. Some people talk about carbon markets 2.0, where we have an opportunity to learn from those things that didn't work in 1.0 and fix things. And you're seeing the standards like Verra and the others making improvements, developing new standards, replacing old standards, taking those out of circulation. You're seeing initiatives like the ICVCM and others trying to help buyers with guidance. And then you're seeing ratings agencies also in the ecosystem now with information that allows people to buy with greater confidence and less risk.
So just out of curiosity then, if I wanted to buy A or A+ grade carbon credits, what sort of projects should I be looking for at the moment? Obviously, that's going to change over time, but
yeah, and there's a variety there, David. There's in the kind of AB range, and then those are the really good ones, and those with perhaps a few splotches, but still okay. We see projects with more of an industrial type, like some arcane types, like ozone depleting substances destruction, and nitrous oxide abatement, but also some more that speak easier to the imagination. We have some of our highest rated nature-based projects, which are some agroforestry projects with smallholder farmers that have a B+, if I'm not mistaken. We have some waste-related projects such as landfill gas, methane capture. So there's a variety there.
Now, just turning back to forestry projects, of course, that's where there's been a lot of concern and quite negative sort of press around that in the past 2 years. So what are the main worries about these projects, and why are many of them sort of towards the lower end of your rating scale?
So Yeah, we cover a broad variety of nature-related projects, from conservation, so the red projects, but also reforestation, afforestation, grasslands, blue carbon, and improved forest management, and a few other types. And we see them varying from, I think, B-plus right now is the top of what we have, and E, and you're absolutely right, David, there's a concentration more on the lower side of that range. It depends a bit sub-project type by sub-project type. Some of the big conservation projects struggle with permanence and overcrediting. Overcrediting is a problem that arises in this particular case often because the baseline assumed by the project, so the counterfactual, what would have happened had this project not been there, how fast would the forest have disappeared without this project having been there. Sometimes the assumptions made on what would have happened in the absence of the project were significantly aggressive. And we've seen in some cases that that led to 2x, 3x, 4x overcrediting or more. And that's obviously an issue, because if you're going to offset a ton of real emissions, you want to make sure that the ton you're using as an offset is also a real ton. Otherwise, you get into that weird situation where you get one real ton and a quarter of an offset in reality. But some other project types, yeah, suffer from permanence issues, like the project has a limited duration, say 20 or 30 years, and very limited information and clarity of what's going to happen after that period. And also, the standards didn't require historically very much in terms of monitoring after the project period. Some other types may suffer from additionality. Some large-scale commercial plantation forests would have totally existed without additional carbon finance. Yeah, some of these 100,000 hectares of acacia plantations, yeah, those would have existed in any case. So it depends on project by project.
Great. Now, are we seeing sort of a shift towards the demand for the higher quality credits? And sort of related to that, what are the sort of key trends that you're seeing now? For instance, has the market shifted in the past 2 years or so?
Yeah, I think the market is becoming more sophisticated. We are seeing people asking for integrity, and that comes in the guise of either what they assume is higher quality, or people are asking for ratings. So we have quite a few customers of ours who are actually in the business of reselling credits, either as a trader or a broker or a marketplace of some kind. And they talk to us often about their customers asking for rated projects, and sometimes specifically Calix Global rated projects. So that to me suggests that customers are becoming more sophisticated. Sometimes you see people taking some heuristic shortcuts and saying, well, I'm going to assume that removal credits are better than reduction and avoidance credits. That doesn't always totally hold through. It'd be a bit of a shame for Mother Nature if we only did removals and stopped doing reduction and avoidance. But yes, the market is becoming more sophisticated. We have seen some of the projects that have been higher rated by us, some of these landfill gas projects that were totally off the radar. We sometimes refer to them as the ugly ducklings of the market, not very charismatic, but actually pretty good in terms of their greenhouse gas effect, that we hear stories anecdotally of developers completely selling out. Same with some of these industrial types that I spoke about earlier. And so also when it comes to high quality reforestation projects, those are in very high demand. And the flip side is also true. We are seeing instances where some projects really are having trouble selling. And you've seen that reflected in the prices for some projects that have had poorer ratings. And so that's something we're aware of. And it puts a lot of onus on us to make sure we do this properly.
Yeah. So I guess that means that over time, you would expect projects that have the sort of the lowest rating and the lowest prices will eventually start to get pushed out, I suppose, particularly when there's corporate reputational risk sort of issues at stake.
Yeah, I think you're pointing to an area where we would see the impact of what we and others in this ecosystem are doing, that you'd see that being reflected in prices and price discovery, that projects that rate highly fetch higher prices, and adversely those that don't get lower prices. And so our mission as a company is better carbon markets for the benefit of the planet and for people. And so that mission, we will see progress towards our mission as the market starts readjusting. Yeah, we are here to try and move that market to the A-plus direction. And that means realignment. We hope that higher prices for good projects, provide an incentive for developers to say, hey, that's what I'm going to be focusing on, so that the supply on that side increases. And yes, adversely, projects that at an E level or close thereto that really don't make much of a dent in climate terms, that, yeah, those gradually phase out of the market.
I suppose I should just ask you this question, that your clients are not the project developers themselves, right? Your clients are the buyers. So it's not like project developers are sort of paying you to give them good ratings.
No, thanks for raising that, because it's something we're very, very conscious of at Calix, which is this aspect of safeguarding our independence. And that's exactly why we chose not to do an issuer pays model, which you've seen in financial markets for some types of ratings, where the issuer pays for the rating. In our case, it's a buy-side pays model. And so, no, we don't take money to rate projects.
Just on one last point, and that is, and we've touched on this already, it's what's called the non-carbon benefits of carbon offsets or carbon credits. And this includes particularly improving the livelihoods of local communities near these projects. So why is this an important, an increasingly important additional sort of element to the effectiveness and integrity of carbon credits?
I'm so glad you raised it, David, because this is hyper important to us. Yeah, as I said just now on the mission, better carbon markets for planet and for people. We think some of these projects present a huge opportunity to do something for the livelihood of communities, to do something to protect biodiversity and other important sustainability goals. And that's another reason why we think ratings is important. We want people to have real evidence-based information when they make decisions. Hey, I want to buy this credit because I see some of these benefits, and these benefits are rated highly, as in I can really feel secure that that impact is likely to be achieved. And as a result, again, on price discovery, we would like those credits to be valued higher than those who don't make those contributions. An interesting anecdote perhaps here is we have a number of our customers, it happens to be companies in the tech sector, who've chosen deliberately to buy credits that had a low rating on our scale, I guess even E and E plus, and said, look, we're not buying these credits as offsets. We will not use them to compensate for emissions, but we buy these credits because we love what they do with communities. And Calix Global, you've rated those contributions to those community programs, and you've rated them highly, so we have confidence that that's for real, and that's why we're doing it. And so I love that. It's perhaps an early sign that there is a market also for other types of impact other than the climate impact that the carbon market has traditionally been solely focused on. And then there is the other aspect related to sustainability, which is making sure that there are no negative consequences. And that's why we try to assess environmental and social risk.
Great. Look, thank you so much for joining us today, Duncan. That was a really great rundown. I've certainly learned a lot today. So that wraps it up for Green Pulse today. Once again, I'm David Fogarty, and thanks for listening.
Send your feedback to podcast@sbh.com.sg. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or within our Straits Times app. Thanks for listening.